This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a fascinating phenomenon going on in the United States right now. You know, at the extreme end of despair, you see, for example, the Palestinians in Gaza, who are, you know, hey, we've been living in a prison camp for years and years. We have no jobs. The septic systems don't work. The water systems don't work. The hospitals are understaffed. The stores are half empty. There's massive unemployment. And if we go up near the wall to or near the fence to protest, they shoot at us. By the way, I heard somebody this morning on one of the television networks saying, well, yeah, any country in the world, if you had people coming up to their fence like that, would shoot at them. I suspect that if Donald Trump had ordered the Border Patrol to shoot through the fence at that caravan from South Mexico, from Central America, to shoot at those people, there would be hell to pay in the United States. But anyhow, I heard that argument being made, but I don't buy it. But in any case, that's one extreme end to paraphrase Bob Dylan, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. The other extreme end is, you know, the United States in the 1950s. And things were going well. There was not much protest. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't any protest. People had jobs. The economy was growing. Unionization was hitting 30%. You could go to college for free on the GI Bill. You could get federal subsidies for your house. Doctors made house calls. It cost $300 to go to the hospital and have a baby. I mean, there was a time in the United States when life was good, at least for white people. For some people of color as well, but mostly, I mean, we were still an apartheid country. But still, there was a time in this country when, broadly speaking, things were not insanely terrible. So you've got that spectrum, or let's say that the other end of the spectrum would be Denmark or Norway or Sweden or France, where you know, basically people are not protesting, people are not upset. And in between, let's say Denmark, you know, the happiest country in the world, and Gaza, probably the most miserable place in the world, in between those two is us. And this study just came out from the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association. They insure 106 million people, which should give you pause. But, you know, shouldn't the government be doing that? But anyhow, between 2013 and 2016, in a three-year period, major depression cases skyrocketed. The jump is reportedly even more serious among children and young adults, with depression diagnoses rising 47% in millennials, 63% in adolescents. This is somewhere between a 47 and a 63% increase in major depression among our young people. Now, no doubt some small part of that is attributable to discussion of depression, online discussions of depression, education about depression, people seeking medication, pharmaceutical companies advertising on television and saying, hey, are you depressed? We can make you happy. You know, stuff like that. You know, some of those things are driving it, but I suspect that there's much more to it than just that. And I'm curious your thoughts on what you think would be contributing to this too. This study by the CBS station in Chicago suggests, and they're quoting Dr. Karen Haywood, who says increased use of electronics, video games more commonly in boys, and social media and texting more commonly in girls can lead to increased conflict both within the home and among peers. High users of social media have been linked to higher rates of social isolation than low users. So she's suggesting that it's basically our phones and our computers. But I think it's a lot more than that. And I'm curious your thoughts on this. And I'm not looking for stories of depression. What I'm looking for is your opinion on why are people depressed? And let me give you some possible answers. You know, some brainstorming that I did on, you know, what could be behind this. Among this generation, we have massive student debt, and among the younger people, the prospect of massive student debt. If you go to college, which everybody wants to do, or not everybody, but many people want to do, you go to college, by the time you graduate, you're going to have to spend the first 30, 40 years of your life just paying off your student debt. Because the for-profit college industry and the for-profit banking industry and the politicians they own who changed the bankruptcy bill in 2005, they all got together and said, let's screw young people and make the banksters rich and make the billionaires, the DeVosses of the world, you know, who support or own for-profit charter schools and private schools. Let's make them rich. So is it student debt? Is it global warming? I talked to some young people a couple of weeks ago. I was down in Los Angeles and hanging out with some friends of mine, and they had some kids. And one of their kids was saying to me words to the effect of, we all know that by the time we're your age, this world is going to be in a whole world of hurt. There's going to be millions of refugees. There's probably going to be worldwide war. And large parts of the United States may not even be habitable. We all know this. So is it climate change that's causing depression? Is it the corruption of politics, what I was talking about in the last hour? The fact that you know, the Donald Trump administration and the Republican Party in general are so corrupt. And there's parts of the Democratic Party that are corrupt as well. You've got Democrats who are absolutely just as much as Republicans in the pockets of big insurance companies, big bank companies, big oil companies, big gun manufacturers, you name it. Now, it's a small percentage of Democrats, and it's 100% of the Republicans, but it's there. And it's all brought to you, by the way, courtesy of a group of Republicans, or Republican appointees, 100% of them Republican appointees on the U.S. Supreme Court, as I mentioned in the last hour. 13 out of the last 17 Supreme Court appointees were appointed by Republicans. And if they can't do it honestly, they do it dishonestly, the way Mitch McConnell prevented President Barack Obama from having his appointee, Merrick Garland, on the Supreme Court for almost a full year. So is it the corruption of government? The feeling, you know, as Gillens and Page pointed out in this Northwestern University study back from about 3 years ago, we had them on this program talking about it, that if you're in the top 1%, your political priorities actually get enacted into legislation. If you're in the top 10%, your political priorities, you got about a 60% chance of them getting enacted into legislation. If you're in the bottom 90%, your political priorities are completely irrelevant. The probability of them being enacted into legislation are statistically identical to random noise. There is no measurable relationship between what the bottom 90% of Americans want and what Congress actually does. So is that what's causing depression? Is it that our society has become, and has been becoming since the 70s and 80s, really, with the rise of Ayn Rand, libertarianism, objectivism, the whole Libertarian Party, the Ron Paul, Rand Paul phenomena, all this stuff, has become basically more vicious, more cutthroat, less compassionate, less concerned for people, more concerned for billionaires? That our political discourse and our ongoing discussion is becoming more libertarian. Is that causing children to be depressed, and young people, and adults for that matter? Is it the school shootings? The fact that they know that every day that they go to school could be the last day on earth? I mean, you know, I grew up in a world where that never even occurred to me. I mean, we were worried about the Soviet Union launching missiles, but we didn't even take all that seriously. Is it the guns? Is it the rise of right-wing hate? Is it that white people are beginning to learn what people of color have known forever in this country, which is you can't even walk down the damn street without having your life at risk? You can't go buy a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea like Trayvon Martin did without ending up dead before you get home. You can't have a taillight out like Sandra Bland did. You can't sell loose cigarettes on the street. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. We've got, like Eric Garner, we've got this long list. I mean, you can't barbecue at a, you know, like the family did in Oakland. And of course, for centuries, people of color have had, you know, good and solid and legitimate reasons to experience depression or rage or PTSD and the whole spectrum of stuff. But is it possible that as young people, as white young people are becoming friends with people of color, that they're beginning to empathize with them, and that that is now spearing across our political dialogue? Is it the right-wing hate? Is it the fact that right-wingers now are responsible for more deaths in the United States, more murders, more political terrorist murders in the United States than even so-called Muslim terrorists? Is it that? Is it that the right-wingers, you know, that if you're gay or if you have friends who are gay, now we're in a world, you know, I mean, you know, look at how fast gay marriage was ratified. We're in a world now where young gay people and young trans people are not afraid to come out. And so, you know, is it that they're identifying with their friends? Is that why they're depressed? You know, what's going on here? Is it the rise of right-wing hate that's causing this depression? And by the way, all of these things that I just shared with you, from the student debt to the global warming to the corruption of politics to the, you know, more libertarian, less compassion, to school shootings, to the rise of guns, the rise of right-wing hate, all of these things brought to you courtesy of the Republican Party. So is it the Republican Party and so-called conservative right-wing hate politics that is causing this explosion of depression? Or is it something completely different from that? Something I'm completely missing because I'm so blinded by being a lefty. What do you think? Why are we seeing this explosion of depression and anxiety?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I have shared my theories with you. We will check out your theories in just a moment. And welcome back. Let's see here. Greg in Gulfport, Mississippi. Hey, Greg, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. You wanted to talk about the whole mental health thing?
Yes, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I would just like your opinion real quickly about the possibility of the mental health professionals, along with the pharmaceutical industries, misdiagnosing a lot of people that are just possibly going through situational crisis from loss of a loved one or bad health into a clinical depression diagnosis. It seems like that happens quite a bit, and before they even have time to really get through the grief stage. I'd just like your opinion on that, please, sir.
That's an excellent question. I was speaking with a friend of mine who's a physician about something like this just a few days ago, and his take on it was that 30 years ago, if somebody presented in his office with, a parent who had died or a child who had died or, you know, best friend committed suicide, the kinds of things that tend to throw people into a temporary but very real depressive episode, that if somebody presented in his office like that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and they wanted medication, he would prescribe to them something like Valium, you know, in other words, a short-acting, relatively short-lived, relatively non-addictive. I realize the benzo drugs, if you take them every single day in large quantities over a long period of time, are insanely addictive. But generally speaking, when used as directed, you know, over a short period of time, just a few weeks, just to get past it, they're just fine, right? He would have prescribed that. Now, he said, the benzo drugs have become radioactive, and in large part because the SSRI industry is sponsoring all these studies trashing the benzos. And so now you've got these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor drugs and Prozac and family. And those drugs are really designed for long-term use. Because they're so addictive. Addictive is not quite the right word, but I think eventually we're going to start calling them addictive. I have known people who tried to kick SSRI drugs and they end up with electric shocks in their brain. They've described it as being harder to kick than nicotine. Nicotine is 5 times harder to kick than heroin. So we're talking about a serious problem here. So now when somebody goes in and says, my girlfriend left me, or my dog died, or my best friend committed suicide, or my father just died, they're given Prozac, or, you know, it's equivalent. And the problem with that is that after 4 or 5 weeks, first of all, it takes a couple of weeks for them to kick in. And then secondly, after 4 or 5 weeks on this stuff, you know, basically you can't stop. And so for years now, you've got a patient, which is exactly what the pharmaceutical companies want. But you've also got somebody who is diagnosed as depressed and on medication for it over a multi-year period rather than just a few weeks. And so that may be skewing the statistics. Does that make sense, Greg, as an answer to your question?
Oh, I agree 100%, and thank you so much, Tom, for always telling us the truth. You're one of the few people left, and I hope you're on the air forever.
Well, thank you. Forever's a long time, Greg, but I'm going to keep doing this as long as I can. I have a good time doing it, and you know, and I think it's important work. I think that's something, you know, we all strive for, is something meaningful in our lives, and this is certainly that for me. Greg, thank you for your kind words, and I think spot on. I think you're onto something. We'll be right back. It's 22 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So what is it that is driving depression in the United States? Is it, you know, another possibility was brought up during the break is that we're simply seeing, you know, it used to be when people were depressed that they were given short-term drugs. They were given things like Prozac or other drugs that, or in some cases, the anticholinergic, the antihistamine family of drugs. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the brand names, but that could get somebody through a crisis over the short term, and then you could simply stop using them. And I realize benzos can be insanely addictive if you use them in large quantities over long periods of time. But typically somebody using benzo drugs, Valium, you know, for a couple of weeks to get through, hey, you know, my dad died, my kid died, my dog died, my girlfriend left me, whatever, you know, is something that could be done. And now we're giving people SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors instead, which remodel the way the brain works. And the brain actually grows new serotonin receptors to make up for this, which makes you more vulnerable to these swings in serotonin, maybe for the rest of your life. Nobody's really sure. Nobody's done the research on this. But what we do know is, you know, anecdotal reports from people who try to quit using SSRI drugs is that, you know, when they no longer need them. Now, some people need them for a long term, and I'm not saying that there should not be SSRI drugs. But for the many people who went in for episodic depression and ended up on SSRIs and now can't get off them, they're discovering that when they try to quit, it's actually more difficult than trying to quit heroin or nicotine. You get these electric shocks to the brain, you feel insanely depressed, you can't sleep, all these problems associated with it. So it may be that the statistics are simply all screwed up because, you know, with the vilification of the benzodiazepine drugs, the Valium family of drugs, by basically the manufacturers of the SSRI drugs, you know, these PR campaigns that are being run against the benzo drugs, that you've got more people on these things, and so that's skewing the statistics. But I personally suspect that that is not what's going on, because we've had the SSRI drugs with us for 15, 20 years in a big way. Jack in Harrison, Michigan. Jack, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. Your thoughts on this?
Hey, Jack. Took you off speaker.
Thank you. Appreciate
okay.
it.
I think that it's a cumulative effect of all the things that are going on that young people can see that they have no control over whatsoever.
Hmm.
You know, it's...
So your answer is all of
you
above.
You know, they know about the environment, but they see adults around them just, you know... Oh,
doing nothing, yeah.
It doesn't matter. Oh, they hear the crazy talk radio and stuff like that, and you know, but oh, that it doesn't matter. What is, you know, it's only somebody's opinion.
So broadly speaking, Jack, what you would say is it's all of the above, but not just all of the above. It's the lack of response to all of the above that's causing the depression. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, great. Because that's the thing. You know, what I've noticed throughout my life is, and this isn't depression, it's anger, but the one thing that makes me angry is not having the ability to do something, feeling powerless. And that's
gotta
be it.
You're
listening
to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
I think Jack's onto something. We'll continue the conversation right after the break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Some interesting thoughts on Twitter here. This is fascinating. Jen Smith says, as a professional therapist, I work with kids. I notice that many kids are inept at resolving conflict and have increased anxiety and depression. Lack of unstructured play and lack of recess leave little time. Brilliant. You know, little time for kids to engage in playground conflict in order to resolve conflict. Added to isolation through electronics leads to decreased social engagement. Kids need play, lots of unstructured play to understand social norms. In the U.S., we push standardized testing and performance over natural child development and therefore child emotional development, and the result is child anxiety and depression. Bingo. Raven Dawn had tweets. I think the things that could be behind why millennials, Gen Z, et cetera, are depressed is, number one, the food. You know, we're eating more and more crap food, and our bodies, you know, don't work or look the way we want them to. Number two, phones and computers. Number three, global warming. Number four, student debt. Number five, school shootings. And number six, right-wing politics. Fascinating stuff. Kyle in DeKalb, Illinois, you wanted to weigh in on the previous hour. Hang on just a second, Kyle. Before I put you on the air, I just want to make an announcement, essentially. We always ask, when you call into this program, we always ask you not to put us on speaker. It sounds like hell. And when people say, hang on while I put you on, while I take you off speaker, it cuts 10 seconds out of the show. And you add those up over time, and it's cutting minutes out of the show. And people would like to get to their topics, and people would like to know what's going on, rather than listening to people saying, hang on, I got to take you off speaker. When I put you on the air, there is a loud whoosh that is generated by our telephone system. And that's how you know you're on the air. And if you're on speaker and you say, hang on, I'm going to take you off speaker, I'm going to dump your calls from now on going forward, period, world without end, amen. So, you know, get you some earbuds, get a pair of headphones, whatever it takes, but you've got to listen to your phone because your radio is on a 7-second delay, your TV's on almost a 1-minute delay. So, you know, our obscenity delays and whatnot. So, you know, listen to your phone if you want to go on the air. And I realize it could be a long time, but, you know, hey, it's a call-in show. That's the price you pay. I'm not charging you to go on the air. Kyle in DeKalb, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Kyle, what's up?
Hey, I'm going to talk about what you just talked about real quick. I've called into other shows, and call screener, I guess, will pop on once in a while and tell you, but in particular, right before you go on, they say, okay, you're going on in 10 seconds. But it's also really confusing when you're on hold with yours, because you go back and forth between the show.
Yeah, I got that. Kyle, I'm not going to have that debate with anybody on the air. Joe in Cupertino, California. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Thank you for the in-service training. I'm ready to go, I can tell you.
Thank you.
Like the topic, we've talked about this in the past. I have two kids, and they're in school, and they're just so much different. But what I did with my son is I took the electronic device away from him during spring break.
Mm-hmm.
He has to have it in class. It's important. But we leave it at school. So he doesn't have it at home. He brought it home accidentally on spring break, and I took it away, and I says, you know, look, I'll hold on to it. And then he snuck in the bedroom, and he started, what do you call that, vamping when at night. He says, all my friends do this. We talked about it. And I've been trying to educate myself to the extent that I can. I think that for some people, especially young boys, this is too much for them to handle. It leads to depression because everybody else is doing it, so that's a kind of a peer pressure.
Well, I think it's true for young girls, too. I just think that the dynamic is slightly different. With young girls, it seems to have more to do with body image and social status.
Right, it's the social.
And with boys, it has to do more with, you know, who's on top, bullying, hierarchy, testosterone kind of stuff.
Now,
but there's a lot of crossover for both, particularly for overweight boys or, you know, whatever, yeah.
Right, but I have to admit, as a parent who's not very tech savvy and whose wife is much more savvy, we as parents are not setting the right example. We're not modeling the behavior that we want in our children, so our children are doing what we're telling them not to do. My kids are really quick to point that out, though. But I agree with the other caller, the suggestion of that we need more recess, more structured outside conflict resolutions that they're not getting because they're in this social environment where it's online. Mm. I wanted to one more comment, and I'll let you go. You've sure. talked about medication for this problem, and I have been very opposed to it. But I recently observed some sort of a marketing scheme where they're using the MRI to focus on the brain to try to get the flow where you go from, you know, being stored. I don't know if you saw that, but I just thought...
Oh, you're talking about this new product on TV where they zap your brain to deal with depression.
Right, and I don't know if that's something that you would consider appropriate for a child, but, I mean, it's better than drugs if it's a
well,
nerve
maybe.
Thing. I don't know.
I think anytime you introduce anything into the brain, even if it's just radiation, I get pretty nervous about that. But frankly, Joe, I don't know enough about that product, how it works, or what its side effects are to discuss it. Sorry.
Well, I really appreciate, though, that we're talking about not using medications as opposed to lifelong dependency on a chemical that, you know, as you say, you only get so much of this serotonin in your bloodstream. If you use drugs like GHB and all these other things, you expunge all that, and this is why depression occurs later in life for some people because of their recreational drug use as an adolescent.
Yeah, there may well be that connection, too. Joe, thanks for the call. And just, you know, for the record, I want to say I'm not anti-medication at all. My concern is that some of these medications that are really, because of how addictive they are or how habituating or whatever the appropriate word is, more appropriately should be used long-term or even lifelong, are being used for short-term conditions, and then people are ending up stuck on them for the rest of their lives. Cody, but I don't want to turn this into a discussion about drugs. Cody in Villa Park, Illinois. Hey, Cody, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to chime in on the, I'm a millennial, and everything you listed as far as you had the question of what causes the depression, it's pick one. It's all of them. It's four of them. However, the more aware you are, the worse you feel.
Hmm. So what's the solution, Cody?
We got to take everything back, take over.
Bingo.
Gone on long enough.
Yeah, well, there's an old maxim in the field of psychotherapy that the things that are the most difficult to deal with are the things that people can't do anything about. And even conflict with a dead parent, for example, how do you do that? Well, in a therapeutic situation, you have them imagine that parent is still being alive and have a conversation with them. So you try to get to the point where you can do something about something that seems like you can't do anything about it. But the best cure for depression and anxiety is motion. It's to do something. It's to get involved, to get engaged, to feel like you're helping to solve the problem. And that's another one of the problems that we have is that one of the messages that our culture and particularly our news media sends to young people is you can't do anything. And I suspect that probably one of the most effective antidepressants out there in the United States right now are the students from Parkland. Because they're demonstrating to other young people, you can do something, you can produce change, you can raise hell, you can get out there and do things. Excellent points, Cody. Thank you so much for sharing your experience with us as a millennial. Kevin in East Elmhurst, New York. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, as a millennial, also I agree with Cody that it's all the above, but I just want to add this variable to the discussion of our over-competitive nature as a country. I think we reached a tipping point where we just can't outcompete each other for happiness. Your thoughts?
Oh, interesting. So it's kind of the old squirrel story. There was a study done back in the 70s where, if you've ever looked in the wintertime at trees, you see these squirrels' nests, you know, they're about a foot and a half in diameter, and it's just a whole bunch of leaves. And squirrels build nests, and they all tend to be the same size. And so these scientists, and I think this was at MSU, as I recall, but it was, you know, back when I was a teenager, they added leaves to some squirrels' nests to make them about 20% larger. And what they discovered was over the course of the next year that all the other squirrels in the neighborhood made their nests larger. So it's like there's this keep up with the Jones thing that's wired into us as mammals. And so if we are seeing you know, other people being amazingly successful, or all of our friends talking about how wonderful their life is on Facebook because they never talk about how miserable their life is, only how wonderful it is, then we start using that as the metric against which we gauge ourselves, and we end up judging ourselves to be not as good as everybody else. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, along those lines. We are also competing for likes on, as you said before, on Facebook, on tests. I mean, it's leading to people to cheat. It's just, I don't think it's sustainable at this point. And just bringing it back to, I guess, I think I've watched a video with Professor Wolf. It's just, I think it's capitalism's tipping point at that point. At
yeah.
This case.
Yeah. Well, these are all dimensions. You know, hyper-competitiveness is right out of capitalism. Kevin, thank you. Very well said. Heather in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Heather, we got about a minute, a little more than
okay,
a minute.
Okay, hey
up?
There. I'm interested in the whole depression malaise that has taken over our culture. And I really believe that it has to do with, you hit it on that last call, mammals. We are animals, and we have separated ourselves from the natural world.
Bingo.
And as we're alive, we're seeing the sixth greatest extinction.
And not only that, we don't let our kids go outside and play.
And think about all of the chemicals in the brain that are generated by the interaction of being outside amongst nature, amongst our fellow beings. And not only that, but the interaction between the very soil. We are getting chemicals, we are gaining them from the actual soil. And I think that is lost. And I think that there is a really deep mourning from that.
Yeah.
And so what I have done is whenever I have a friend, son or daughter who's graduating from college, my gift to them is a permaculture training course.
Wow. Put them back. I'm sorry, go ahead.
What it does is it teaches them, A, that they're not alone, but it teaches them that they have a way out of this.
Yes, they are connected with all life on Earth. That's brilliant, Heather. That's absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. And I would say just, you know, take them out in the woods from time to time, right? It's real.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, a lot of psychiatric hospitals have started painting their rooms green because they've discovered that when people are exposed to green, they get less depressed. What is that? Trees, grass, green. And welcome back, John in McKees Rocks, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Tom. I just have a comment to make about how I feel the country's getting. It's like the movie Once Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because, if you recall what happened in that movie, I mean, they're getting everyone addicted to prescription drugs. There's a pill for everything out there today.
Yeah.
Everything. And you see the side effects on a lot of these drugs advertised on TV. That's been coming out since the 90s. Nothing but advertisements, pharmaceutical companies. Now, a lot of these advertisements are full of side effects. Now, I would just have a question. How is any of these drugs even legal when it could cause a bunch of serious side effects? And you're taking a medicine for depression, and one of the side effects for that medicine is suicidal thoughts or behavior.
Right.
So I really think it's, you know, what you just said and your callers, previous callers, brought up excellent points. It's really about change. Changing the direction of life, and mainly people are waking up to reality and realizing how hard and difficult life really is.
Yeah.
And this is why, you know, I think a lot of people can't handle this today. But is it rather than working on yourself, is rather taking a pill that's going to put you to sleep away your problems? Because most of those psychiatric drugs are just making people want to sleep.
Yeah.
And they're not really handling their own problems in life at all.
So the drugs are making things worse by postponing the reckoning, the internal psychological, you know, doing the work, healing yourself kind of stuff, or healing your relationships.
Yes, Tom, how many people you know right now that's not on any prescription drugs? Most of the people I know are.
10% of Americans are on some sort of psychiatric drug, some sort of psychoactive drug. That's a mind-boggling number. John, I want to get one more caller in here before we hit the break. Thanks for the call. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael.
Yeah, hey, Mr. Hartman. I think the reason that the world is so depressed right now is because we've finally reached that point of subconscious realization that we're on the wrong path. You know, after we genocide, the Native Americans, enslavement of people in America here, tied together with we call ourselves a Christian nation. So I really think it's a fundamental, we're stuck. You know, we want to do what Jesus professed, yet we can't because we're stuck in capitalism. And all we see is that top 0.001% benefiting. So I think deep down, subconsciously, we're all just, we know where the game is going. What do you think, Tom?
That makes a lot of sense, Michael. And you know, it's kind of a variation on, or it's an addition to my list. So it's basically, here's the list of things. And you know, people realize that these in aggregate mean we're going in the wrong direction. We're destroying the planet. We're destroying ourselves. Also that a small number of people can get insanely rich. And that feeling of helplessness associated with it.
I agree, and we have the perfect example of the Native Americans. Like you've always said, you know, it was a matriarchal society, egalitarian, and once we chose that road to capitalism, we thought everything would be beautiful, but as we've seen, you know, they were around for, what, 20,000 years, 25,000 years, and doing fine, thank you, until we came over here and destroyed everything.
Yeah, remarkable. Michael, thank you for the call. Excellent points all. I appreciate the call. We'll be right back. We're going to check in with Talk Media News, I believe, in just a moment. Stick around. So let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. On the line with us is Luke Vargas, the chief foreign correspondent for Talk Media News, working out of the UN Bureau in New York City. And you can follow him on Twitter at The Courier. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Good. So what do you see as happening in the world today? What are the top stories?
I'll get to some of the specifics in a second, but we're just learning that the State Department hiring freeze is over. So America can start staffing up diplomats in all of the new conflict zones that we
what provoked that change?
Presiding over.
Is that Pompeo's efforts?
This is a decision from Mike Pompeo. He had a statement saying the workforce is our most valuable asset. We need men and women on the ground executing American diplomacy with great vigor and energy. I mean, this is the kind of on paper, at least, the exact kind of wording about the sort of central role of diplomacy that people, you know, have expected from, you know, bipartisan presidents in the past, and just we hadn't gotten really a dose of with any credibility for the first, you know, year or so of the Trump administration. So
that's real interesting.
The hiring is back on because between all the certain initiatives we've got in play right now, we're going to need people. And I guess I'll segue to what's happening here at the United Nations today. You had faced with the Gaza violence yesterday at the Gaza Israeli security fence, the nation of Kuwait asked for a special meeting of the UN Security Council today. And even before they were able to meet, you saw on full display the ability, the intention that the United States is really going to prevent the establishment of any sort of mechanism here that would force the Israeli government to be investigated or held to account. Yesterday, the Kuwaitis sort of circulated a statement which just expressed dismay at the fact that there were deaths yesterday, and that was blocked by the United Nations, by the United States. And then today, there was an attempt to call a vote on a resolution that would establish a UN probe into deaths in Gaza, and the U.S. blocked that at the committee stage as well. So we are going to, you know, defending this right on the world stage. And I guess the next thing we should watch, and I don't even need to get into the rhetoric of today's Security Council meeting too much because we have had plenty of discussions about how that forum is essentially just used as a way of not even working towards concrete objectives anymore and just sort of pontificating. But that on Wednesday, we believe, Kuwait, with a number of co-sponsors from various Arab states that are in and outside of the Security Council, is going to put up a resolution calling for protection of Palestinians, perhaps, and that we don't think this is going to be this time around, but it could be in the near future, proposing actually a new UN peacekeeping force, which would you know, be in charge of monitoring these border zones where violence has occurred. And I still think we're a few steps away from that, but that starts to get us into sort of in the realm of reality, where we're actually talking about what kind of mechanisms could we create here to prevent any government that's so invested in this Gaza crisis from being the ultimate, you know, power to pull the trigger, and maybe trying to get some more sort of independent forces in there who might be able to take a more balanced approach. So we'll see what happens with that. But yeah. I wouldn't expect the U.S. to sign up on that either.
Yeah, that'll be tomorrow, you said.
Yeah, we're thinking it will be introduced on Wednesday. I mean, my hunch is the U.S. will signal in the committee phase our lack of interest in supporting that resolution. So it may not even come up for a vote. Maybe we work on it behind the scenes for a long time and water it down to the extent that it passes American muster. But I guess the thing I'm watching the most right now is whether a country like Saudi Arabia, which in recent months had, through their crown prince when he was in New York, basically signaled a few weeks ago that, hey, you know, we're not willing to put our relationship with the U.S. In jeopardy by just supporting the Palestinian cause indefinitely, and, you know, even if there's no peace process going on.
Well, I think it's even going to go a step beyond that in being transactional, and that is that Saudi Arabia is essentially saying, we'll overlook the human rights violations of Israel at Gaza if Israel will overlook our human rights violations in Yemen.
Yeah, I think that's a key part of it as well. And the pressure now is going to be, you know, can you be, because the Palestinian cause is really so much of a shared issue between these Arab states, to what extent can the crown prince sort of engage in that kind of transactional relationship with the Israelis when his population wants that country to put its full, you know, pressure behind the Palestinian cause? And we saw Queen Rania from Jordan today issuing a very, very strong statement saying exactly that this Palestinian cause is the shared Arab cause in the region. And so will U.S. allies, you know, where will they be pulled? Will they join in these big photo ops at the U.N. between all the Arab ambassadors, or do they try to prioritize the U.S. relationship? That's going to be, I think, right.
And will Saudi Arabia,
a breaking point where we should watch.
Right. And will Saudi Arabia drive an ice pick through the middle of it, or, you know, whatever the proper metaphor is for something that splits things apart. Interesting. Luke, what else is going on in the world?
I'll say very quickly, we're getting some reports from the Washington Post about what the U.S. is now expecting in the possible sort of agreement to come out of the North Korea talks in Singapore next month, which is that Mike Pompeo is sort of pursuing a new definition of denuclearization that doesn't mean destroying everything, sort of denuclearization that the U.S. and North Korea could both accept. And I will joke, even before I give you the details, it looks a lot like what we were hoping for in the Iran nuclear deal. I mean, eliminate biological and chemical weapons. That's obviously no connections to the Iran deal, but dismantle the ICBMs to cap nuclear capacity and enrichment. So it's not actually give up all the nuclear material. And in exchange for that, economic rewards, the thinking being, and I have reason to be skeptical about how much this would happen, that, you know, the U.S. would sort of try to encourage, you know, private companies to go and do business with North Korea, which I don't think is a big enough market and certainly too risky of one to want to dive into.
Well, this is essentially what Pompeo said on TV over the weekend, was that, you know, instead of building America's infrastructure, we're going to build North Korea's infrastructure so that Trump can have a win on the foreign stage.
He seems to be willing to give up a lot in order to get a deal. So the momentum, I don't know if it's in his court, at least right now.
Amazing. Luke Vargas with Talk Media News. Thanks, Luke.
Thank you.
Talking with you. Yeah, always great talking with you. We'll be back. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.